This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There's nothing on Earth we depend on more than oxygen. It's in the air we breathe. It's in the very, it is the very constituent of water. And way up in the sky in the upper atmosphere, oxygen in the form of ozone shields all living things on our planet from harmful solar radiation. But oxygen has a darker side. On the surface of the Earth, ozone is a byproduct of the cars and trucks we drive. And here it's the stuff of smog. Those bad air days we experience in the summer are a measure of that harmful ozone. On the other hand, new research now shows that ozone is also produced by our bodies. It helps fight infection, but also plays a part in inflammatory diseases such as atherosclerosis. So today we're broadcasting from the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Seattle, and this hour we're going to be talking about oxygen, everything you've ever wanted to know about it, we hope. What it does in the human body, how it behaves outside our body. The story of its discovery is an 18th century drama that raises questions about the very meaning of scientific discovery and what it means to be first. And oxygen takes the stage. The play Oxygen has played around the world. It's been translated into 10 languages. We'll talk about smuggling real science to the public in the form of a good story. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in our audience here in Seattle, please step up to the microphones and give us your questions. You can also surf over to our website at www.sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to our topic. Let me introduce my guests. Bassam Shakashiri is the director of the National Initiative for Science Literacy, the William T. EU Distinguished Chair for the Wisconsin IDEA, and professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Welcome to the program.
Happy to be here, Ira.
Good to see you. Mary Jo Nye is a Horning Professor of the Humanities and a Professor of History at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Carl Girasi is a playwright and co-author of the play Oxygen. He's also a Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at Stanford in California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Paul Wentworth Jr. is a Professor of Chemistry at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla. He joins us today by phone from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's begin with a little history of oxygen. Mary Jo Nye, we were all taught in the textbooks that it was Priestley who discovered oxygen. It's not quite that simple, is it?
No, the discovery of oxygen is a classic example. As you said, it's a good story. And it's a classic example of simultaneous discovery, what's often called simultaneous discovery, but with a real race for priority at the time in the 18th century.
There were three scientists involved.
There were three involved, and in fact, Antoine Lavoisier, in 1789, in his textbook on chemistry, which he meant to be widely read, made the claim that Joseph Priestley, Carl Scheele, the Swedish chemist, Priestley, the English chemist, and Lavoisier himself had about the same time, as Lavoisier said it, discovered what he called vital air, and then Lavoisier renamed oxygen. But in fact, there's very good evidence, including documentary evidence from Scheele's laboratory, which was published in the 1890s, that Scheele, possibly as early as 1770, certainly 1771, 1772, had in fact isolated and studied the properties of an air contained in ordinary air that supports combustion, respiration, and what they call calcination and we call oxidation.
And did he write up his research here?
He initially was not writing it up, but continued his work. However, he became a member of the Swedish Academy of Sciences in Stockholm, and he reported his results to the secretary of the academy there. And Scheele himself wrote a letter to Lavoisier, which was written in September of 1774, in which he described to Lavoisier a way in which to produce this new air, which Scheele called fire air. It's not clear, and this is something that's made evident in Carl and Roald Hoffman's play, whether or not Lavoisier read the letter. He never acknowledged having received it or read it.
So where does Priestley enter this whole thing?
Priestley was a well-known English chemist, had some other professions too, including being a Unitarian minister. And Priestley was experimenting with all kinds of airs beginning in the 1760s, including what we call carbon dioxide and what at the time was called fixed air that had recently been discovered. And Priestley, it appears in August, and this is usually the date that's given for the discovery of oxygen, Priestley in August of 1774 isolated an air using a very simple procedure of a burning glass with mercuric oxide, which is a red powder, which we call it mercuric oxide. They called it red calx of mercury. And he isolated an air, and he wasn't quite clear what it was, but he did isolate it, characterized it qualitatively in some ways, and in October, following that August isolation, visited Paris, was at a dinner party, and told Lavoisier and other Parisian chemists on that occasion about this, the way to isolate this particular air. There's evidence that Lavoisier then first collected some of it within a month or so, but was busy doing other things. Priestley then, in it was March of 1775, published, hence priority, published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, an account of this air that he called eminently respirable air that supports combustion, respiration, calcination. And Priestley then, he published it. Within a month, Lavoisier read a memoir at the Paris Academy in which he reported that he had isolated the air from the red calx of mercury, didn't mention that Priestley had told him how to did it, also didn't mention Scheele. And he read a memoir, which was then later published, and in this particular memoir, Lavoisier said that he had found an air which he thought he took to be a particularly good part of ordinary air. Priestley then publicly said that Lavoisier had gotten it wrong, that it was a particular air, not just some particular portion of common air, that it was different from common air in very important ways. And Lavoisier went back and did some more experiments, called it vital air in 1776, and then in 1777 he renamed it oxygen, claiming that he had done a series of experiments in which he demonstrated that this particular air is a constituent in all acids. And oxygen means, in from the Greek, generating acid. And so oxygen means a substance that generates acids. Turns out all acids don't contain oxygen.
See, Carl Gerassi, it seems like this is fertile stuff for a drama here. I mean, it almost like writes itself. I'm not taking away from your play, Oxygen.
You are taking.
tell us, is that why you chose this topic to write about?
No. As you correctly pointed out, I'm now a playwright, not just a chemist. And our play is much more complicated than that. Uh-huh. We happen to pick oxygen to try and really talk about the fundamental theme, what is discovery, number one, what does it mean to be the first, and to describe a really competitive nature of science, a brutally competitive one, which we think is only competitive now, and we don't realize how much worse it was in some respects 200 years or 300 years ago, because at that time people worked alone. So it was, you really talk about I did this. And in fact, the story just heard, Lavoisier was the first one to really start using the royal we, because he initially accepted the fact that Priestley first published and about Scheele, but then he said we did things together, and of course that rubbed Priestley very much the wrong way. So we first of all wanted to really talk about that. Secondly, we wanted to point out, my own colleagues, I know it is a professor in chemistry and so on, we don't teach really the history of science. You have to go to historians, you have to go to classes dealing with the history of science. We don't really teach that in chemistry. And I'll give you a brutal experiment. Our play premiered in 2001 in San Diego, same time at the American Chemical Society at its national meeting. There were thousands of chemists there, including several Nobel Prize winners in chemistry, whom I knew, and I decided to carry out my own personal survey. And I went around to the three Nobel laureates who were there at that time and came to our play. Before I saw them, I said, tell me, who is the discoverer of oxygen? These are Nobel laureates in chemistry. Not one of them could give you the correct answer. They could mention one or sometimes two of the three people. That's point number one. One of them, in fact, said he didn't remember. None of them knew where the word oxygen comes from. And I find that really embarrassing, but typical of how we teach chemistry. We don't really pay attention to the history of our discipline. That is really true of science altogether. We pay much, much attention. But so we want to do something about this, too. And the third thing, that was exactly the centenary of the Nobel Prize. And we suggested something in our play that some newspaper thought was real. We said to celebrate the Nobel Prize, the Nobel Foundation decided to create a new Nobel Prize called the Retro Nobel, which would be given to dead people rather than to living one, which I think is a marvelous idea anyway. And so our play really goes back and forth between 1777, exactly the time that you mentioned, and 2001, where the Nobel Committee decides who should get the first Retro Nobel in chemistry. For that, you first have to pick a discovery. And one of them said Mendeleev, obviously the periodic table. And someone says, nah, you got to go early on that. And it's oxygen, because when the chemical revolution started. So in the play, we really start in 1777, and we see through the wives of these people, because we also want to bring in the issue of women in a male-dominated discipline, which is a recurring theme in every one of my plays that deal with science. This is the second one. So Roald Hoffman and I picked that particular combination. And the scene that you heard here described by the historian, Professor Nye, we postulate that the king of Sweden, that was King Gustav III, who was very much in favor of competition, decided to have his own competition and invite the three people to Stockholm, Lavoisier, Scheele, and, well, Scheele was there, and Priestley, and have him demonstrate in front of the public, as you're going to see it right now here. I don't know how you're going to do it over the radio, who actually made oxygen first. And you'll see these experiments done in front of them. And tomorrow, when I give my own presentation here, I'm going to show some videos how this is done in different theaters, how, for instance, it was done differently in Wisconsin, Korea, and in England, just to give an example.
And Dr. Shakshiri is going to demonstrate for us.
Yes, I will indeed. But before I do that, I really want to point out that this marvelous play that Carl Gerassi and Roald Hoffman wrote was produced last March in Madison by University Theater. And we, the National Initiative for Science Literacy, captured that on video. We have made a DVD, which is now available, accompanied by a study guide and a couple of other interesting things that people might find useful. This is available from Educational Innovations in Connecticut. Just simply go to the web, www.teachersource.com, or the telephone number where you can get a copy of this very wonderful packet that Professor Gerassi just mentioned by calling area code 203-229-0730.
Now, if you forget all of that stuff, you can go to sciencefriday.com, where our website has all that on there. Just could have saved you a little bit of time, but you're gonna come back. We're gonna have to take a break now in a very short bit. You're gonna come back and I'll let you go down to the demonstration table we have set up for you. And Dr. Shakshiri is very famous for his demonstrations. He's been doing them now for 35 years, approaching his 35th anniversary at Wisconsin doing these. And he's going to show us some of the properties of oxygen. We're going to have everybody stand back from the demonstration table. And we're going to take a short break and see what oxygen has as a power. And stay with us. We'll be right back. We'll take your calls. And we'll also talk about some of the science, new science about ozone in the body when we come back. So stay with us. A lot of stuff to come. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about oxygen with my guests, Bassam Shakshiri, Mary Jo Nye, Carl Gerassi, and Paul Wentworth. And before we go to Paul and talk about some interesting research at Scripps having to do with ozone in the body. Dr. Shakshiri is setting up his oxygen demonstrations here. And I want you to know we've taken all our safety precautions. We have a fire extinguisher. We have trained people who know how to deal with all this kind of stuff. Don't try it. We have to say don't try this at home. Can you try this at home, Dr. Shakshiri?
Some of them you can try some at home. Yes.
All right, well,
but safety comes first, Ira.
Yeah.
Always. Safety comes first. That contributes immensely to the
appreciation and understanding of what we're doing. So I'm going to take a match and strike it.
This being radio, I'll try to do the color play-by-play of what's going on.
All right. So
you're lighting a splint of wood. And we have a glass bottle filled with oxygen.
Yes. It's, of course, colorless because oxygen is invisible, right? And I blow out the splint, right? So we have just a glowing splint, and I drop it in there.
Whoa. Whoa, look at that. It's flared right up.
So the more oxygen we have, the more combustion that we have. So this will disintegrate pretty quickly. See, it's a lot brighter. It was just a glowing splint, and now it's almost all gone. It is, in fact, all gone right now. But if we take oxygen and pressurize it, that is oxygen gas, and we make liquid oxygen, we have to be very careful when we do that. I have made some liquid oxygen here, and I'm going to show the effect of the high concentration of oxygen when it's liquefied.
When you liquefy it.
By the way, it's a very pale blue liquid.
Oh, look at that. Yeah, very he's holding up a beaker.
Liquid. Yes. And to
test
do this,
tube of oxygen there.
To do this experiment, you're doing the play-by-play description, right?
That's it. And you're putting a cigarette in his mouth. Okay, this is the first. Don't try this at home. Lighting a cigarette, inhaling the cigarette. Cigarette is now lit. Now I have an empty beaker, and you're going to take the cigarette and putting it into a small beaker. Okay, cigarette in the beaker. Taking now that liquid oxygen, cold, pouring it in. Whoa, whoa. That's like, looks like fireworks. Whoa. It gets brighter and brighter. It looks like you could almost burn a hole in the bottom. Wow. So that's... That is much more, as you say, much more intense. Don't try that at home, please.
This is the complete disintegration of the cigarette, Ira, and that's what I think we should do with all cigarettes.
All good smokers. All right. Thank you. Thank you. That's a terrific demonstration. Was Dr. Shakashiri, was that something at all? They demonstrate how explosive, almost explosive oxygen is. Is oxygen explosive or is it just burn very quickly?
In order to have fire, you need oxygen. Oxygen has a great tendency to grab electrons from other substances. Mm-hmm. And that's what combustion is all about. Of course, you need to have heat to get it going. Oxygen is in the air. It's 21% of what we breathe is oxygen. The other is mostly nitrogen. Mm. But you know, interestingly, Ira, it hasn't always been like this. Billions and billions of years ago, the amount of oxygen that's in the air was a lot less than what it is now. What's striking to me is that it wasn't until only 230 years ago or so that oxygen was discovered. It's a fantastic comment that I really make about how much progress we have made in science in the past 200 years. Now, not only do we know about oxygen, we know about compounds of oxygen, hydrogen peroxide and other compounds.
Ozone.
And ozone is a...
Why is ozone considered bad for us, even though oxygen is good? It's three atoms of oxygen versus two, right?
Right. Ozone is an allotrope of oxygen gas. People know about allotropes because they know the different forms of carbon. There is carbon in diamond, there's carbon in graphite, and there's also carbon in buckyballs. These are different forms of the same element. Ozone has three atoms of oxygen, highly reactive. It's also blue, but it is toxic. And at the lower, on the surface of the Earth, it is not very friendly to us. But in the upper stratosphere, as you mentioned earlier, it is very helpful because it does block off radiation, harmful radiation, UV radiation, that gets to the surface of the Earth. And so ozone is a very interesting molecule. And what is really fascinating to me is what Professor Wentworth and his colleagues are making discoveries now. Ozone is in the body.
Well, let's go talk to him now because he's on the line. Dr. Wentworth is at Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla. Dr. Wentworth, you've discovered that there is ozone in our bodies. Our bodies make ozone?
Yeah, that's right, Ira. As part of the immune system, immune defense, part of the pathway seems to be the production of trioxygen species, of which ozone is one form. We actually, in very close collaboration with Richard Lerner, who's actually going to talk at the AAAS meeting tomorrow in your session, he's going to explain how we sort of made this discovery and how the whole science has moved forward. But essentially what seems to happen is that antibodies, that is the protein constituent of what's called the adaptive immune system, have this intrinsic ability when presented with a high-energy form of oxygen, that is singlet oxygen, have the ability to generate, among other things, ozone and hydrogen peroxide. So, in fact, ozone is indeed generated within the body.
And what does the body do with it?
Well, it uses it as part of its defense mechanism against invasion by foreign bacteria, against viruses. That is its positive role, seemingly. And, you know, we have shown as part of our studies that when antibodies are presented with singlet oxygen and they generate the ozone and hydrogen peroxide, that you can, in fact, use this process to kill invading bacteria.
So the antibodies make the hydrogen peroxide and the ozone?
Correct.
And then they gobble up the bacteria?
Exactly. Essentially, what happens within the immune system, you have two arms to the immune system. You have what's called the adaptive and the innate. The innate immune system comprises mainly of cells called monocytes, macrophages and neutrophils. They are relatively nonspecific, so they can go around the body and really not be targeted. The role of the antibody generally within the immune system, the adaptive immune system, is to target the cells to the bacteria. Now, what we've discovered, in fact, is that by doing that, what happens is the antibodies can utilize a singlet oxygen that's generated within the monocytes, within the cells, and use that to generate ozone to facilitate the killing of the bacteria.
Could you tweak it up and make it, you know, more effective antibiotic or perhaps an antiviral?
You know, obviously these thoughts have occurred to us. And, you know, what would you love to be able to do would be to increase the potency with which you generate these very, very reactive oxygen species. And, you know, one of the ways that you can consider that this could occur would be really to sort of increase the antibody concentration. You know, this has not been thought to be relevant within the immune system. You will normally think about increasing the number of inflammatory cells, that is the phagocytes. But what we found is that because the antibodies can generate this, it would be very nice to increase the concentration of antibody molecules in the body.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. And so I guess this will continue. You'll be going further along with this research, looking for
exactly. And one of the things that we found, of course, in all cases of the immune system, you have the good side and you have the bad side. And of course, one of the things that we've recently found is that sort of the flip side of this pathway is that it can be actually damaging, and it seems to be relevant in a number of inflammatory diseases. We have looked at atherosclerosis, which is an inflammatory disease associated with the cardiovascular system. And what we've noted in that particular disorder is that this pathway is traceable within the actual artery, and that there are unique products, biologically active molecules generated as a direct result of a reaction between ozone and cholesterol. Now, cholesterol, as you know, is bad for you in cardiovascular disease. And what we found is that a direct reaction product of cholesterol and ozone is formed, and that this molecule is very bad for you.
Oh, wow. So could you tell how much cholesterol people have by measuring the ozone that might be in their blood?
The standard method for measuring cholesterol is pretty well defined. But what we've discovered is that this molecule may be, more importantly, a marker for a sort of the progression of cardiovascular disease. Now, there is no biological marker for that exists right now. But what we found is that this molecule, these ozonation products of cholesterol, are present within your plasma. And so the point is you could actually use this molecule as a marker for late-stage cardiovascular disease. And, of course, at that stage, then you would go to your cardiovascular surgeon and sort of, you know, you would need surgery. Right now, there is no good marker to sort of let you know what that may be. But we think that these ozonation products could be those kind of markers.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let me remind you, we have a shy audience here today, I can see. It only takes the first person to get up there, and then the flood opens up. Happens every year. And that first shy person is approaching the microphone. We're not in Minnesota here. Okay. Sir, do you have a question?
Yes. There are many examples of simultaneous discoveries of the same phenomenon. And I was just wondering if any of you could comment on what the larger social, political circumstances might have been at the time that Shayla and Lavoisier and Priestley made those discoveries. Why is it that this kind of work was going on at that time?
Dr. Gerasi, Dr. Nye?
it's Carl Gerasi. That was really the time of pneumatic chemistry. It was particularly pronounced in England, but as is usually the case with simultaneous discovery in any area of science, when the time is ripe, things happen. And in, you know, if Mendel had never lived, if Einstein had never lived, if Newton had never lived, within a few years, maybe a decade, maybe just in the case of DNA, within 3 or 4 weeks, if it hadn't been Watson and Crick, someone else would have come up with this, which is very different from other creative areas. Shakespeare, Cervantes, Mozart, Bach. You know, if he had not lived, that, whatever they did, would not have been done. And that, I think, the time was ripe. Science is a very vertical proposition. You depend on the work of your predecessors. And one knew enough about this, and the interest was there to try and determine the nature of air. If you actually even look at the nomenclature that was used, you hear it in our play, you heard it, of course, from Professor Nye, you know, they call it fire air, respirable air, etc., etc. Finally, you had a formal name of oxygen. But I think the time was ripe, and that happens almost always in science. And that's when you have simultaneous discovery, and that's where our pathetic desire to be first is really pathetic, because it doesn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Nye?
Yeah. Well, I would just add to that that, I mean, one of the things that this and other so-called simultaneous discoveries is used to illustrate is the way in which discovery is a process rather than a single event, and that it's a process for the individual. It's also a process for the collectivity and the community. Mm-hmm. But as Carl says, this is a period in which many people were experimenting with the new pneumatic apparatus, and were called, they thought of themselves, as one historian has put it, as hunters of airs. And so the airs were there to be discovered, and lots of people were discovering different airs and giving them new names. But what is part of Lavoisier's accomplishment is the way in which he then developed a new system and then translated the old system into the new system in a very self-conscious way that was almost immediately successful.
In fact, Shaler and Priestley thought oxygen was part of this phlogiston, right?
That's right.
And he said no.
That's right. Lavoisier and some of his colleagues, too, really formed their new chemistry as an attack upon the phlogiston framework, which can be thought of as a kind of inverse of oxidation theory, so mm-hmm. that instead of an air or a gas being absorbed in processes of respiration or calcination and these kind of processes, they thought that an elastic fluid or an elastic air was being released. Mm-hmm. And the notion was that air is needed for combustion or respiration to occur, because the air is the air actually absorbs phlogiston, and as air becomes saturated with phlogiston, then respiration or combustion can no longer occur. And so when Priestley called this air that he isolated from the red calx of mercury dephlogisticated air, what he meant was that it was an air within ordinary air that accounts for combustion, because it absorbs just about as much phlogiston as something can put out.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about oxygen this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatto in Seattle, and let's go to the microphone, sir.
I have a question regarding the antibody and ozone pathway, and I was wondering if the ozone is complex with the antibody or if it's secreted from the macrophages.
Dr. Wentworth?
Yeah. The ozone is generated on the antibody and then is freely diffuses away from the antibody into the environment. The interesting point about I sort of touched on it briefly in the previous segment, is that you require the macrophages and the neutrophils to generate the sort of the starting point, the substrate, which is singlet oxygen. That then binds to the antibodies. That reacts with water, in fact, in the form of oxidation. So singlet oxygen oxidizes water, and then from there you generate ozone as a byproduct of this pathway, and then that leaks freely out into the environment and reacts with the bacteria or, in fact, biological molecules.
Does this mean that you, now this is just a layman's question, that if you take oxygen therapy, if you breathe in concentrated oxygen, you could tweak up your immune system?
The oxygen that is in air is what the low energy form. It's called triplet oxygen, and that is a different kind of molecule to the energy that the oxygen that we use for this pathway, which is singlet. The singlet oxygen has a different kind of chemical reactivity. Ground state oxygen is a biradical, essentially. The higher form is more, they have what's called spin paired electrons, so its chemistry is somewhat different, which is why it's sort of an interesting chemical pathway. Normal oxygen that you breathe in does not react with the antibody, but the singlet oxygen generated by the macrophages does, and it's only that form. So, you know, inhaling more oxygen really isn't going to tweak up your immune system.
Dr. Gerasi?
All right. If you haven't already had such a program, I suggest you have one on nitric oxide. The combination of N nitrogen and oxygen, which incidentally was also subject to a play of mine as a result of it, where this story that you just heard happened even more dramatically. That's a gas, again, a poisonous gas, destroys the ozone layer, etc., known for over 200 years. And 16 years ago, we discovered we produce it in our body, and it has an unbelievable number of biological effects, including the ones that you just discussed with respect to ozone.
If you hang around to the end of the program, we have a rap song that I know that you know about.
Thank you. Thank you for that publicity. But I do want to make that one point about nitric oxide. So people asked, can you take nitric oxide? Exactly the question you had, the gas.
Right.
Because nitric oxide is also involved in penile erection. That is really the mechanism whereby Viagra works. So the question, instead of Viagra, could you just take a tank of nitric oxide and just in...
It would be cheaper, I think.
Yeah, and you would die in the process. Yes.
Let's solve one problem. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go right here to this gentleman.
It's a little more mundane, but you hear about the role of forests as living lungs of the planet, and I wondered if the role of plants, in particular trees, is important for producing oxygen, or is it more as the fact that they take up carbon dioxide?
I'm going to let everybody think about that answer, because we have to take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the role of oxygen in nature there, and whether trees are how they're involved. And we'll take your questions from the telephone. So stay with us. We'll talk more about oxygen when we come back. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about oxygen with my guests, Bassam Shakashiri, Mary Jo Nye, Carl Gerasi, and Paul Wentworth. And we're going to turn the floor over again to Dr. Shakashiri, who's described for us what you're going to be demonstrating now.
We're using a compound of oxygen, hydrogen peroxide. People know about hydrogen peroxide. You can go to the drugstore and buy 3% hydrogen peroxide. What's it used for, Ira?
I put it on your cuts and things.
Yeah, it's antiseptic. And so if you put some hydrogen peroxide in your skin, what do you see?
Bubbles.
What kind of bubbles are those?
Oh, boy, I'm in school now. Chemistry was bad. Oxygen.
They're oxygen bubbles. They come from the decomposition of hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide breaks down into water and oxygen, but does that very, very slowly. We use catalysts to speed up the rate of that decomposition. And that's what the skin does and other things that you put 3% hydrogen peroxide on. What I have here is a 2-liter plastic bottle that's empty except for some peroxide at the bottom. This is 30% hydrogen peroxide.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
Don't try this at home.
You can't get this in the drugstore anyway.
Okay.
And what we're going to do is take a powder, a black powder. You can see that, right?
Gunpowder?
No, not
black powder. Oh, okay, not
actually
black.
It's called manganese dioxide.
Okay.
And I'm going to add the manganese dioxide to the hydrogen peroxide.
Whoa!
And we'll see what happens.
Whoa! It's bubbling like crazy. Sort of like some vapor coming off there.
Well, it's condensed water vapor.
Condensed water vapor. Whoa! Look at up to the ceiling! Don't try this at home. That was like a jet coming out of the top of that bottle.
So this decomposition was catalyzed by the manganese dioxide. We got lots of water vapor. The heat was released, and the water then water vapor, when it hit the cold air, it condensed, and you saw the plume come out. And you also noticed, Ira, that something happened to the plastic bottle. What happened to the plastic bottle?
It shrunk. Wait a minute.
Of course, it shrunk.
Wow.
Because have you heard of shrink wrapping?
Yeah, shrink wrapping.
You know how that works?
Well, no, they heat it up and it shrinks or something.
You take a piece of plastic and you heat it up. And that's what we did in this experiment here.
Wow.
Shall we do it again?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's do that again. Another bottle. Here goes the black. Whoa, there it goes. It looks like a volcano coming. Isn't that something? It looks like a volcano coming out of the top. And let's watch the bottle shrink, if you can see it. Wow. All right. Thank you very much. That was terrific. Fun with oxygen. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We had a question before the break about the trees. Anybody have any answer to the oxygen question on the trees? No. Well, you're asking a biological question of chemists up here, so we'll try to pass that up. Dr. Gerasi, you call your work science in fiction, your playwriting. In this case, science in theater. As a way to bring science to the general audience, make it more accessible? Would that be fair to describe it that way?
No.
I knew I was going to be wrong on that one.
I want to use a smuggling device.
A smuggling device.
Because if I admit that I really want to make it more accessible, a lot of people get it turned off because they don't want to even learn. So instead of telling them I want to explain to you in easy language something about science or scientists, I simply want to say, I want to tell you a story. Everyone likes to hear stories, and that story has to be valid on its own. But instead of writing science fiction, I'm talking here about my actual fiction, not about my plays. I write about real things, and the same thing in my plays. But I'm trying to use a smuggling device. And so they read it for amusement, for entertainment, for curiosity. But when they're finished, they actually have learned something. Mm-hmm. And that is really what I want to use there. But I also feel very strongly that, particularly when it comes to the theater, because that's so very important, that to show that scientists are not just Frankensteins and strange loves or nerds or idiot savants, but normal people. And I think it's very important to demonstrate this. And I like to do that. I also like to do it even in classes. I write pedagogic word plays, which are only dialogic ways of presenting things, because we do everything monologist. We preach, we pontificate. And I think it's much more interesting to do it that other way.
Let me see if we get a call from the phone here. Josh in Vienna, Virginia. Hi, Josh. Still there?
Hi, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my question. I was curious why, given the different properties of different molecules, why ozone has its own name, but elemental oxygen and the oxygen we require for respiration are both called oxygen. Why there isn't a different name for each?
Dr. Shakashiri?
That's a good question. In fact, when I lecture in Europe and I talk about oxygen, people immediately ask me, what form of oxygen are you talking about? It's called dioxygen. Mm-hmm. But in the United States, we refer to it as oxygen. We typically know we're talking about the gaseous form of oxygen. But the allotrope of oxygen, as we pointed out already, ozone, is an elemental form of oxygen. And people, by the way, Ira, people know about ozone because anytime you push the button on your blender and you smell a pungent odor,
right,
that's ozone, because the electric motor is generating ozone. And so the question about nomenclature is an interesting one. It, of course, it gets more involved as we talk about the different properties of oxygen gas itself. You know, triplet oxygen, which is the common form, it has two unpaired electrons, but the singlet oxygen is different. That's the more reactive. Mm-hmm. And again, it's really fascinating to me how these discoveries are being made of these different reactivity patterns of different types of oxygen in the body. We know about them outside the body, as we've demonstrated already.
Right. I was always fascinated also. I'd seen a biologist put up equations on the blackboard, and I think they called it eventually. This is the Krebs cycle. At the very end, he stuck a little molecule, an atom of oxygen at the end, and said, this is why we breathe. Dr. Wentworth, is that why we breathe, to complete this chemical cycle? And I was talking to a scientist yesterday. He said, yeah, the oxygen pulls three electrons out that we need to pull out, or something like that. Is that true? That's why we have to breathe?
What you're talking about within the Krebs cycle is related to ATP formation, certainly. And for that, certainly oxygen is the electron acceptor at the end of the whole process. Mm-hmm. So that is part of why we need to breathe, certainly for the production of energy in the form of ATP.
So that just to complete that little energy so we can produce energy.
Absolutely.
Wow. Go go through a lot of stuff to make that little bit of energy there. 1-800-989-8255, gentleman at the microphone here.
Our scientists at the U.S. Geological Survey are frequently asked to evaluate water quality in streams, rivers, and water bodies for their ability to sustain aquatic life. And oxygen is obviously a key component to that evaluation. I was just wondering if there's any history or anecdotal stories related to breathable oxygen in water as opposed to oxygen in air.
I don't know about that.
I don't know them.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Sounds like an interesting research project.
Somebody's writing it down quickly. We'll be back. We'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am, over here.
Hi. I wanted to know, how was the findings such as oxygen at that time disseminated out to the public, and if and when it might have been, how did it change public views of other health concerns at that time? I know I've studied how, you know, people were afraid of the ether, or they were afraid of going out in the night air. I'm not sure why that would have been, but is that a correct thing to think about from that era?
Go ahead, Dr. Drossi.
That's a first-class question, because that addresses the issue of discovery that I mentioned. Namely, what does it mean to be first? Who did it first, which clearly was Shaler, as you heard. Who published first, but clearly was Priestley, because he shared it, therefore, with the public. But who understood it first, that clearly was Lavoisier, who made oxygen last. Now, how did they disseminate the information at that time? Shaler, in fact, who made oxygen around 70 or 71, wrote a letter in 1974 to Lavoisier telling him about his experiment, say, please repeat it. And there's no evidence, we discuss in our play, whether Shaler actually got the letter, ignored it, et cetera, et cetera. But Shaler then decided he's going to write a book. And he wrote a book, and he was literally pissed off at the publisher who delayed and delayed publishing his book. On the other hand, Priestley also published all kinds of books, but also sort of articles. But the interesting thing is, what did Lavoisier do? Lavoisier did something we don't have anymore that was called a pli cacheté. This is a sealed letter which you could submit to the Academy, at that time the French Academy, in which you put your discovery, seal it, date it, but do not release it. And so you reserve the right to claim later on, if, in other words, let's say Priestley or someone would publish and say, I've done this and that. And then he writes to the Academy, please open my sealed letter and show that, in fact, I've done it 3 days earlier.
This is like notarizing it, something.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Now, there are all kinds of monkey business happened. Forget about Lavoisier. That system of pli cacheté was very common in European science up until the middle 20th century and misused. But the accepted way of publishing is, of course, through journals or books. The interesting thing is that at that time books were fairly common, and Lavoisier wrote his extremely important treatise on chemistry, which really produced modern chemistry. Uh-huh. And this is why we in our play, Roald Hoffman and I, considered the discovery of oxygen to be so fundamental to the history of science, and why the first retro Nobel Prize, this Nobel Prize for dead people, in our opinion, should have been given for oxygen. But the question is, who should get it?
Uh-huh. We're talking about oxygen this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Nye, any comments?
I was just going to say that another thing, I mean, the airs were very much a part of public attention at this time in general. And, for example, Priestley was the first person who made soda water by putting carbon dioxide under pressure in water. And he was interested in that because he wondered if he put carbon, what he called fixed air in water under pressure, whether it would have the same properties as medicinal waters from the spas and that sort of thing. He also discovered what we call laughing gas. And there was a lot of experimentation, both for fun, but then also for medical uses of that gas. And then another gas I just mentioned now is that it was in the early 1780s that what we call hydrogen and what Lavoisier called hydrogen was first isolated. And there was a real craze for the manufacture and spectacular uses of hot air balloons in the late 18th century. And so hydrogen balloons originated in that time, too. So there was a lot of public interest in these airs.
We've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests, Bassam Shakashiri, Director of the National Initiative for Science Literacy, also Distinguished Chair for Wisconsin IDEA and William T. Iu, Distinguished Chair of the Wisconsin Idea and Professor of Chemistry at University of Wisconsin, Madison. Mary Jo Nye Horning, Professor of Humanities, Professor of History at Oregon State. Carl Gerassi, playwright and co-author of the play Oxygen, Professor Emeritus of Chemistry at Stanford. And Paul Wentworth, Professor of Chemistry at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla. Thanks all for joining us. We're going to go out with a special treat today.
It's the end to the O, you know.
It's the N.O. Rap by Eric Weiner. So enjoy it as we say goodbye for this hour of Science Friday.
It's such a hot topic, and you saw it today in A and B and BC's horseplay. And here we are, y'all, nearly at the end of it. But before we go, we want to recall all the benefits. If you take notes, you can use your pen. So once again, the key applications of NO. They made it very clear in the first section that without the NO, you would get no erection. And without the erection, there would be no humping. So that's gotta tell you NO is useful for something.
Number two,
NO is healing. Yes, it rocks. It's a possible treatment of septic shock.
Number three,
guess who gives your body protection by somehow fighting off parasitic infections? Did you guess NO? Well, then you were right. If you did, you were wrong. Thanks for playing. Good night.
Number four.
Here's some more information. It combats cell proliferation.
Number five,
make alive because you feel great. That's because NO helps your blood vessels dilate. It's the end to the O, you know it don't stop. It's time to break it down in the form of hip hop. The N is for nitric, the O is for oxide. It's got a lot of scientists riled up worldwide. NO is a neurotransmitter function. That means if you spot someone hot at a luncheon and your brain tells you that you just gotta do something, NO helped you out and now your heart is just pumping. You approach and your blood is flowing like a river. You can also thank NO for that because it helps deliver and regulate your blood flow so you don't go straight to heaven. That was number seven in case you're slow.
Number eight.
Now who would have thought from the start that NO would then go and help the heart? Treats cardiac condition through vasodilation because it's liberated by nitroglycerin administration. I know that's a mouthful, but yo, it's not doubtful that NO is more exciting than Gwyneth Paltrow.
Number nine.
Almost done. Come on, we're on a roll. NO could be useful in birth control. And on the flip side, there's a high possibility that it could even help in improving fertility. That's right, NO has a hand in human reproduction. We're almost at the end. No need for introduction, because in conclusion, it's no illusion that NO is a powerful, helpful solution to many different problems and needs of the body. Sometimes it does nice things and sometimes naughty. Who would have thought that we'd start all these talks again from one atom of nitrogen, one atom of oxygen? If someone says nitric oxide, now you know. Tell them like Nancy Reagan to just say NO.